With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
An ordained minister has decided to give up God for a year.
How the heck do you just up and become atheist after being a pastor?
What I'm most worried about right now is figuring out how I can live openly and honestly.
I am finally free to be me.
I have no idea how to find friends or become a part of a community that's not religious.
What does life look like after church, after religion, after God?
That's it in a nutshell.
This is the Life After God podcast, a conversation on the space between belief and unbelief and beyond, with your host, Ryan Bell.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Life After God podcast. I'm Ryan Bell, and this is episode 69. I'm excited to share with you another conversation in what has become my ongoing series on ex-evangelicals, people who have left evangelicalism due to abuse and marginalization, an erasure of the voices and experiences of women, LGBTQ individuals, people of color, and frankly, anyone that doesn't fit within their very narrow view of the world. I consider myself an ex-evangelical, though the term didn't exist back when I left the church in 2013, and the Seventh-day Adventist Church is only marginally evangelical, but close enough. Where the Adventist Church misses the evangelical mark, it misses to the right in most ways. Today, I'm talking with Emily Joy, co-founder of the Church2 hashtag that you may have seen if you're on Twitter or other social media platforms. If you're not familiar with this, you will be by the time we're done here. You'll also have more reading to do if you wish. I'll be linking to several articles in the show notes that will round out your knowledge base, not only about Emily and her experience, but about the Church2 movement. Before we get to my conversation with Emily, I wanted to say what a great time we had on Friday night with our first live hangout. There were 8 of us that were able to join, and I'm grateful for each and every one of you that joined in and contributed to this ongoing conversation about the sources of ethics and how we should apply ethical ideas in our lives as people who reject a divine command theory of moral philosophy. Special shout out to Aaron Rabinowitz, philosopher extraordinaire and co-host of Embrace the Void and Philosophers in Space podcasts. If all goes well, Aaron will be my guest right here on the next episode of the podcast. Finally, if you missed the hangout, the recording will be available for members later this week, so keep an eye out for that. And speaking of members, this podcast is brought to you, as always, by the members. I want to especially thank those of you that have joined as members since the last episode, specifically Gretchen, Jessica, and Claudia. Thank you so much for your support. These individuals, along with 56 others, make this podcast possible so that it will be available without cost to everyone who needs or wants it. If you would like to be a part of this group of individuals who help to produce this podcast, I'd like to invite you to become a member. All you have to do is go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/lifeaftergod. You can contribute any amount you like as a recurring monthly donation, from as little as $1 up to as much as this podcast is worth to you. The membership level starts at $5 a month, and I'll put links to all of this in the show notes as always. In addition to knowing you're making this podcast available for people who need it, you will also be joining a growing community of people who are thinking, talking, and working together on what a meaningful life after God looks like. When you become a member, you'll be able to join the Facebook group where members discuss podcast episodes, share and support one another, give feedback, and so forth. You'll also have access to the recording of Friday night's hangout with Aaron Rabinowitz. Today, my guest is Emily Joy. Emily is a spoken word poet, a yoga teacher, and an activist living and working in Nashville, Tennessee. Her advocacy takes place at the intersection of faith, sexuality, and healing, and her work has been featured in Time, Cosmopolitan, Jezebel, Mother Jones, The Huffington Post, and more. Emily is the co-creator of the Church2 hashtag, a Me Too spinoff exposing sexual violence in Christian churches and other faith communities. She is also a sexuality education writer for the website Scarlatine, and in her spare time works at a church. More about Emily and her work can be found at emilyjoypoetry.com. You can also find Emily online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at the username emilyjoypoetry. And of course, I'll include links to her social media accounts, as well as articles, as I mentioned, by or about her in the show notes. So without any further delay, here is my conversation with Emily Joy. Emily Joy, welcome to the Life After God podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, what a pleasure. It's been so interesting to follow you on Twitter these last many months. And
yeah, interesting is one word that people use for it.
Right. I think I first heard about you from Chris Stroop.
Oh, and, wonderful. I love him.
Yeah. And he was on an earlier episode of the podcast. And, you know, you came up in conversation. And ever since then, I've been wanting to have you on the show. And so I'm really excited to get into this. I guess to get us started, why don't you go back to some of your earliest religious and spiritual memories? And I'd love to hear what that was like for you. What was spirituality and religion like for you as a kid?
Yeah. Well, for me, like as a child, spirituality and religion was everything. It was the end all and the be all. It's all there was. My dad was a Southern Baptist youth pastor when I was born. And then later ended up kind of starting his own nonprofit that essentially put us in the position of being basically stateside missionaries, where we were still support raised, but just not international. And we would travel around and he would preach at all kinds of different churches, all kinds of different youth camps and retreats and conferences and festivals that were all, you know, Christian and largely conservative Christian in nature. And so for me, it was all of life.
And would you say it was a mix of positive and negative sort of emotions around it or what? How would you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think especially given my experience, you know, a lot of people have the experience of growing up in like one particular denomination and stuff. And that's not my experience. My experience is growing up in almost every denomination, every conservative Protestant denomination that you can think of. We spent time in, from, you know, Baptist to Calvinist to people who speak in tongues and everything in between, you know?
Wow.
And, so for me, it was really a mixed bag. When you are in that sort of environment, you get the sense that like, On the one side, you get a really good sense of like, oh, there's not one way to do this. There's lots of ways to do this. And like, and it's okay for us to be in community with people who do it lots of different ways. And so and that was kind of a message that I internalized. But then in addition to getting the best of everything, you know, you also sort of get the worst of everything too. So it's definitely a mixed bag.
Yeah. So many people that I talk to say that they had really a wonderful experience as a child, because a lot of times, you know, church involves other kids and sometimes involves, you know, lots of food and camping trips. And
oh, yeah. Well, and especially because I was homeschooled. And so for me, church was like school. You know, church was my social life. Church was where all my friends were. And so church played a really important part, I would say, in that, like socially as well.
Did it feel when your dad was it's like a self-supporting pastor? Did that feel insecure to you as a kid, or did that just seem like normal life?
It did more just seem like normal life. You know, we definitely played a part in it. I can remember all of these like silly like camp songs that my dad had us memorize. And sometimes we'd go around to like places that were going to maybe give us money, and we would stand up on stage and like sing the songs. We were like the Von Trapps.
and that's great.
Yeah. So, I mean, we definitely played a part in it. We traveled around with him because, you know, the here's my seven kids thing, or six at the time. But here's all of my children who will go hungry if we don't have money.
That's great. That's a strong appeal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where are you in the birth order?
I'm the oldest. I'm the oldest of seven now.
Wow. And does it match like your experience with what they say about birth order?
I definitely got the brunt of my parents' theological experiments, for sure. Yeah.
Right. You were supposed to be responsible and a good example for your siblings.
Well, and you know, when they were like, oh, maybe we should listen to James Dobson about abstinence and sex ed, we're going to do the James Dobson tapes. Did my younger siblings get that? No, they didn't get any James Dobson tapes.
They were too young at that point, but you got all
of it. Well, they didn't even get it when they got older. I'm just saying, like, it's like one of those things where, like, you almost get, like, whatever, like, theological thing they're trying on, like, you get the brunt of it as the oldest.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, I can relate to that. I'm an oldest, but only of two. So when
but you still get it.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you, you write, and so much of what's been written about you and what you've written and the stories that you've appeared in talk about a moment in your young adult experience in the church that sort of was the beginning of what eventually became Church 2, the hashtag that you invented, that you coined. What was that like? And again, just obviously you've been asked this a million times, and so whatever you feel comfortable sharing is I feel bad even asking sometimes, but
no, it's fine. I mean, I really think everybody says that whenever they ask me that question, it's like, whatever you feel comfortable sharing. But truly though, like, I mean, at this point in the last 14 months, I've probably told this story like 100 times. So it definitely gets easier with repetition. And you know, I'm still actively in therapy, so I am taking care of myself. But yeah, no. So essentially what happened was, like I had said, we were sort of like a traveling stateside missionary family. We went to all different kinds of churches. But when we weren't traveling, we kind of had a home church at this non-denominational evangelical megachurch in my hometown, which I believe had some Baptist roots, but really essentially was basically just trying to be Willow Creek. Willow Creek was like their dream. Wasn't everybody. but yeah, so this was this church that we went to, you know, on the regular when we weren't traveling. And at this church during my high school years and culminating when I was 16, I ended up being sort of romantically groomed for a relationship by an older youth leader who was in his 30s. He wasn't the youth pastor, but he was a very well-respected leader in the youth group who all the kids looked up to, all the parents really trusted. It was this whole thing. So when that happened and when it came out that that was happening, what happened was I was viewed to be at least partially at fault in all of this. The church kind of swept it under the rug, didn't really tell a whole lot of people. I think they told some, but the parents, most of the parents definitely didn't know and continued to allow their children to have access to him. He, you know, left that church, was sort of made to leave that church, but went on to work at other churches, with other youth groups. And so was never really held accountable for it. As far as my family went, my parents, blamed me for it. The last time that I ever spoke to my abuser, was when they had me call him to apologize.
My word.
You know, then of course I was punished and grounded and all that sort of thing. So it was definitely made out to be like, I did something wrong.
You seduced him or something, or like,
I mean, it wasn't even that. It was a very weird experience where, I've never known. One of the reasons I didn't come forward about it for so long was because rape and sexual assault is not a part of my story. Mm. It was definitely going there. You know, I think one of the things about grooming is I always sort of compare it to like how you can boil a frog without it knowing if you just turn the water up 1 degree at a time, you know? And so, you know, it starts by just having, you know, private text conversations, and then you're talking in a corner of a church, and then you're in somebody's car in the back seat and no one else is there. And, you know, this sorts of things. And it's like gradually escalating these behaviors,
right,
so that it feels normal, but it was found out before he was able to take it to a physical level.
Right.
And I mean, there was a lot of technological communication that definitely would have been considered extremely inappropriate. But as far as, you know, a physical relationship didn't happen. And so that's one of the reasons why I didn't come forward about it for so long, because I thought, you know, all these other people have it so much worse. Like that, you know, it's that sort of like self-gaslighting thing that people, and especially women, are conditioned to do. And saying like, it's not that bad, you know? Of course it was this like uniquely traumatizing thing, because like here was this man in his 30s who was like telling me he wanted to marry me, telling me all the things he wanted to do to me, telling me we had to keep this romantic relationship a secret, you know, all this stuff. And I didn't know what to do with that at 16. Like And at 16, you're kind of in that stage where you're like beginning to differentiate yourself, you know, from your parents and become an individual. And so you think that you're a grown up, but like developmentally, you're a child. And so it was just like such a horrible, complicated, traumatizing thing. And I didn't come forward about it for a long time because of that. And because I was blamed for it, when the adults in my life didn't understand that a 16-year-old can't consent to a romantic relationship with a man in his 30s, particularly a man who's supposed to be like a spiritual mentor,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what happened. And then I just kind of sat on that story for like a decade.
Mm.
That's what happened.
Yeah. And so many people do. I mean, so many, and as you know, as anyone that hasn't been like living on the moon for the last 2 years knows, so many women have been sitting on stories like yours and stories of physical assault and rape as well, and really didn't come forward for all sorts of reasons, you know,
yeah.
But they all boil down to this fear, and not just an unfounded fear for sure, but a very founded fear that it would, the coming out about it would affect the woman negatively much more than it would affect the man. And in fact, this has been shown over and over again, hasn't it?
To be true. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford still cannot go outside of her house without security, you know?
Yeah, that's just, yeah. And hers was so public. I can't begin to imagine, even though I sort of was glued to my phone and my television during those days.
That was one of the hardest things for me to watch in the entire world, because I knew exactly what was going to happen. And I was like, you know what? Like, she is a fucking hero. And yeah. I know exactly what's going to happen right now. And she is doing the right thing. And like it's going to end terribly, but it's the right, like, it's the only way she's going to be able to sleep at night. And it's so horrible. It's so horrible.
In my sort of, in one part of my world, I tend to interact with people who describe themselves variously as skeptics or rational thinkers and that type of thing. And of course, those are intended to be compliments, right? To be rational,
sure, yeah.
To be a skeptic. But we encounter so many people, at least I do, and I know I'm sure you must have encountered so many people who really don't understand how evidence works in these types of cases.
Not at all.
We're not looking at DNA evidence or physical proof of something generally, except in very specific cases. What can you describe? I mean, because I think for a lot of people, they can't even understand what that's like to be bearing the burden of this experience and the story that's affected you and scarred you, and yet people don't believe you because there's not this sort of rock solid proof of it or something.
Yeah. One thing about coming forward with a decade old story of abuse is that you really find out like which of your high school friends turned into good people and which of them turned into apologists for abusers.
Wow. Yeah.
Because I had people come out of the woodwork, people I hadn't talked to in almost 10 years, to say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. I knew something fishy had happened. I didn't know what, like, I believe you, I'm sorry. And then I had people come out of the woodwork to say, you know what, like what he did was bad, but it wasn't this bad. He doesn't deserve this. What are you doing?
Huh.
Right. And it's just, it's one of those things where I think like there's different, I don't know, there's different definitions of justice. You know, I don't think, I deleted our emails and our text messages so many years ago.
Mm.
You know, there's absolutely no way, even if, and I'm not even sure, I'm not familiar enough with like the legal, legalese around all of this to know what qualifies, but like, even if you could constitute, you know, some of what he said to me as like sexual solicitation of a minor or something, I have no evidence of that. I have no, you know, I deleted everything because I was shamed. I was shamed. I was so ashamed of everything that I just years and years and years ago when I was a teenager, I deleted it all because I felt so bad and I felt so ashamed of everything. And so for me, I'm like, there's nothing I can do to like bring legal justice to this dude, you know?
Right.
But I will tell you what comes up when you Google his name.
Hmm. Yeah. Your story.
My story comes up when you Google his name. And so to me, that's a version of justice. To me, that's a justice that I can live with. And I think everybody has to figure out for themselves, every survivor has to figure out for themselves, like what constitutes justice to them.
Yeah, and certainly we would have hoped for more justice in especially like in the case of Dr. Ford. But then again, you know, Brett Kavanaugh's Wikipedia page is always going to have, you know, a whole section on the sexual assault allegations that came forward. And that, you know,
I mean, is that going to stop him from taking away my reproductive rights? Probably not.
Yeah, probably not.
But one day his daughter's going to Google that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that's, you know, we don't get a perfect world and we can't go back in time and fix things. But I guess some of those things can bring at least a little comfort that the person's at least not out there scot-free, just doing the same thing to other people over and over again. So when you, about a year ago now, started the Church 2 hashtag, what made you decide you wanted to come forward and what brought Church 2 to mind?
Yeah. It's been over a year now. I just was thinking about that the other day because I feel like 2018, I mean, just personally, professionally, in every possible way, 2018, I felt like was a long ass year.
Oh man. Yeah.
And it kind of just feels like a blur to me. So in my head the other day, I was thinking, did we just start that? But no, we started it in November of 2017.
Wow.
Which seems like a lifetime ago. But yeah, no, ultimately what happened was the Me Too movement was taking off. And that's one thing we've always been super clear about when we're talking about this is like, you know, Church 2 doesn't exist without Me Too. It doesn't exist without Tarana Burke and without all of the brave women that came forward to like build the wave of momentum that has like kept on rolling from then till now and continues to. And so I think, you know, politics and like in terms of like the nuances of Washington and how it works is not my my area of expertise, nor is the nuances of like Hollywood social politics. So these are, and especially being homeschooled, I'm like, I don't honestly know who half of movie stars are. Like some of these, sometimes people get accused of things and I'm like, I've literally never heard of that person. I'm still catching up. I'm at like, I would say probably like 2003 in my pop culture knowledge.
I have a gap in my memory too. When I went to a very fundamentalist college and we weren't supposed to watch movies of any kind. And my girlfriend will sometimes mention if the movie came out between say 1988 and 1994, I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. See, my gap is from about like 96 to like 2006.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's like a whole like 10 year gap where I just know nothing. So anyway, you know, I've been obviously paying attention to the Me Too movement, to the accusations of Hollywood and Washington, but they didn't necessarily have a lot to do with like my experience. And we'd been talking about it like in my friend group. And at the time I was in yoga teacher training, I teach yoga. And it had been a really like common conversation in my yoga teacher training group. It was a group of women, just a small group of women in that class. And we got really close and talked about a lot of really intimate stuff like that. And, you know, one day, I don't even remember who it was at this point, to be honest with you, but it was like two or three other dudes in Hollywood had like gotten accused of something. And I was just sitting at my house alone. And I was like, I just got really mad. So I got on a group chat, like a little group text, and I texted my friends and I was like, hey, should I out my abuser on Twitter? Probably, huh? And they were very supportive of that idea. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do it. So I sat down and I made a little thread. It took me probably an hour. And, you know, I named names. I named him. I named the church. I was very specific and pretty quickly, this was kind of like, by this time it was probably like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And pretty quickly, like people, like just in my own circle started to respond and say things like, oh, something like this similar happened to me. I had this story happen at this church with this youth leader who tried XYZ and blah, blah, blah. And so enough people like pretty quickly started to respond that my friend Hannah Posh, texted me and was like, hey, people seem like they want to have this conversation. We should probably figure out a way to facilitate this.
Yeah.
Because it seems like people are like really, you know, picking up what you're putting down. And so we batted some ideas back and forth, settled on a hashtag. We just picked Church 2 because we were like, well, it's not a lot of characters and we feel like the association will be such that people will understand what it means when they see it.
Right. Yeah. It does, yeah. It's a really quick association.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pithy. And so, I was like, okay, you tweet that out. I'm going to bed. 'Cause the next morning I was leaving on a trip. And you know, both Hannah and I had at the time, like, pretty modest reaches. We expected that we would get like a decent bit of traction out of it. And, you know, hoped that, you know, some media would pay attention or something. 'Cause we'd been having these conversations, you know, surrounding faith and sexuality and abuse and, all this stuff for years and years and years.
Right.
And by the morning we woke up and there were thousands of tweets already and it had pretty much instantly gone viral. And truly it's pretty much been like a full-time job ever since.
Isn't that amazing how that can happen?
Yeah.
Let's go back a little bit. So you at some point along this line, made some decisions about your own religious and spiritual
yeah.
life before you got to the point where a year and 4 months ago or whatever decided
yeah.
to out your abuser. How did that come about?
Yeah. So I don't know. Like sometimes when people like know where I came from and they know that like I was homeschooled and the oldest of seven and my dad was a pastor and then I went to Moody Bible Institute and then they look at me now and they're like, what happened?
Something like, changed along the way.
Yeah. And it's hard because it's like, there's not necessarily like, I mean, obviously the thing that happened when I was 16 with my Church 2 story was very traumatic. And I would say that was a big part of like, maybe that was the first thread. But you know, you have a thread that comes loose and it's up to you whether you want to keep pulling on it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and some people never do.
That's true.
Some people just leave the loose thread there. And so I would say maybe that was like the first thread, but honestly, like, it's not like one big thing that like caused it all to happen. I think it's just a lot of little things, you know, you change your mind about little things here and there. I mean, the Church 2 thing happened, but then I went to Moody Bible Institute. And even though I was at Moody, I was also in Chicago, like one of the biggest cities in the country. And it was
yeah.
way bigger than my tiny little town. And I met a bunch of people who didn't act like what I was told they were going to act. I worked and lived in Boys Town. And I met a bunch of queer folks who, like, my religion said were going to hell.
Mm.
But I didn't feel that way about them, you know, but I was taught to interact with them in such a way that they were, you know. And then so you meet other people and then you have a heartbreak. And then you realize that, like, if God ordained that, he's kind of an asshole. And then, you know, you just, like, one little thing at a time.
Yep.
Until then you wake up one day, a couple of years later, and you're like, oh, I guess I don't believe, like, hardly anything that I used to believe. But you're not quite sure how it happened. It's very subtle. For
yeah.
me, it was a very subtle process.
And because I think religion, well, maybe spirituality and religion for many people operates in the background of their life while they're going on with, you know, their schooling and their work
yeah.
and their families. It's not always front and center to them. And it's kind of these transformations can be happening in your thinking while your sort of the everyday motions of your life can kind of sort of carry on the way they always have. And I know so many people who kept going to church and kept paying tithe and kept doing all the things that they
mm-hmm.
Had always been doing. And then suddenly they reached sort of a tipping point where
yeah.
they were like, this isn't going to work for me.
So I had stopped going to church for a little while in like 2013.
Mm-hmm.
And that was while I was like in the middle of like deconstructing all of my beliefs about like sexuality and stuff. And then I missed it. I missed church.
Hmm.
And so I said to myself, I would like to go back to church. But I don't want to go to any of the churches that are like what I've gone to my whole life. And I knew a bunch of people on Twitter who were, Episcopalian.
Mm.
So I Googled Episcopal churches near me and I picked one with a lady priest.
There you go.
And I went there. and the first Sunday they baptized the baby of a lesbian couple.
They're off to a great start for you, right?
And I realized I had more of a problem with the baby baptism. I was like, that feels weirder to me than like the gay marriage thing. And I just sobbed. Like I just sobbed my entire way.
Wow.
I mean, it was like ugly. I was like ugly crying my way through that entire first service. And so I've been in the Episcopal Church ever since. You know, like most Episcopalians, I show up maybe 50% of the time.
Sure.
When I do show up, I go to a very small, very gay Episcopalian congregation here in my hometown of Nashville. And sometimes I get drinks with my priest. So,
as you do when you're Episcopalian.
Yeah. I feel like that counts too.
Yes, absolutely. That's like personal church. What was it that you missed that made you go back?
I think I missed having a place to bring a casserole.
Interesting. Okay.
You know, that's a great way to put it. I missed having like a place to be friends with like babies and old people, like the intergenerational community. I feel like the way that we live our lives right now is very like generationally stratified.
Yep.
Or stratified, I mean. And so it's very like, if you don't go to church, like where else are you going to get to like hold a baby or be friends with someone who's 50 years older than you, you know, who's not related to you? Like so for me, it was like the motions that I missed. It was the community. It was like the showing up on a Sunday and bringing whatever, you know, a crock pot full of something. Like, yeah, I think that's what I missed the most about it. And so it's, you know, it's interesting. Like in the whole thing about Episcopalianism is like the creeds. And I'm like, I don't really believe a whole lot of the creeds.
Yeah.
So to speak.
Right, right.
Very small amount of them. Actually, last spring I did a 30-day poetry challenge with some people in my poetry Facebook group. And one of the challenges was to make like a found poem, you know, where you take like an existing piece of like a page from a book or a newspaper article or something or whatever. And then you just use the words that are on the page to create a poem and you could like cross out the rest. I thought it'd be funny to do it with the Nicene Creed.
Well, that's a great idea.
It was great. And so I was like, I'm just going to cross out like all the things that I don't like.
Do you still have that?
I'm sure I do in my office somewhere. I can find it.
I would love to share that along with the episode. Folks would probably get a kick out of that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure I can find it. In fact, I think I posted it in my Facebook group, so I can find it.
Awesome.
But yeah, no, there wasn't a whole lot left is what I'm trying to say. It was very minimal. So I would say, I mean, that's kind of where I'm at now. Like I keep showing up. But that was part of my deal. When I joined that church, I sat down with the old priest and I was like, hey, I am not going to get confirmed. Cause I don't believe the stuff, but like I'll show up.
Sure.
And I'll give you money and I'll like volunteer. And he was like, okay. And I was like, all right, we have a deal.
Well, and I found, you know, I used to be a pastor and one of the things I missed was the way that church allowed me to sort of, along with others, put my belief system into practice around issues of justice and equality and compassion and healing and that type of stuff, like whether it was taking care of the homeless or fighting for more affordable housing. You know, the church gave me a vehicle around which I could, you know, carry out those things. And as clergy, it also gave me entree into like a political world where I could speak truth to power. And I was, you know, assumed to have some kind of authority, you know, because I had this title. And then I wasn't a pastor. And all of a sudden, one of the weirdest things for me, I was just outside of all of that. And I was like, I still care about those issues, but I guess I'm nobody now. I've missed that a little bit. The day I reached out to you to ask if you'd be on the show was the day that the Houston Chronicle published the first part of their story about the Southern Baptist churches and the victims there and the perpetrators. And you had a little brush with Southern Baptism along the way. And I think you probably knew something about that story before it actually came out. But how did that whole thing land for you? Was it kind of like, yep, that's what we should expect? Or was it like a big reveal to you?
Yeah, you know, honestly, I just was looking at my Twitter drafts like yesterday, the day before, and I have a very salty tweet in my Twitter drafts that I haven't tweeted about why the hell anybody is shocked about any of that. Because, I mean, truly, like, the people who are shocked were not paying attention. I mean, that's the whole point of church too. When we started it is like anecdotally, we knew this stuff was out there. Like we talk, you know, like women talk to each other, survivors talk to each other. Like we knew all this stuff was out there, but it's just like, nobody would believe us. And I even think of like, you know, Rachel Denhollander has done a lot of work with trying to get more of a spotlight shown on the Sovereign Grace Ministries scandal that involves CJ Mahaney, in which a lot of, you know, folks like Al Mohler and a lot of people had defended him back in the day when that was all happening. And that was a few years ago. That was before Me Too happened. That was, you know, long before Church Too. And it's just interesting because we tried so hard to get attention. I mean, we had a hashtag. It was hashtag I stand with SGM victims. I've been blocked on the blocked by the Gospel Coalition on Twitter for years because I was tweeting on the I stand with SGM victims hashtag. And they basically went through and did like a block of everyone who was tweeting on that hashtag because they were so threatened. By the spotlight being shown on Sovereign Grace Ministries and particularly on CJ Mahaney. You know, Josh Harris, who wrote I Kissed Dating Goodbye, has also, you know, been a part of that story insofar as he was involved with some of those churches. And so, it goes deep. And that's just one. That's just Sovereign Grace Ministries. That's not all the other different kinds of, you know, ministries and organizations and nonprofits and churches and denominations. And we all knew this was out there and we have been trying to talk about it for years. And that's, you know, when we talk, when we have conversations about purity culture, when we have conversations about sexism and homophobia and sex education and all of this, you know, this is a big reason why, you know, like, because we know these stories are out there, because we know what happens when sexuality is not handled well. And so yeah, it's just, I was not at all shocked. You know, I grew up in a Southern Baptist church and, to be frank with you, my dad was my mother's youth pastor. So there's, you know, we've known this forever.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's just one of those things where I think that, you know, the people that are surprised have either truly not been paying attention or they actively turned a blind eye for so many years that they could now become be called complicit.
Yeah, no, I agree. We've talked, our society in general has been having this conversation around Me Too for a couple of years really connecting the idea of power to sexual assault and all the associated abuses. I mean, as you know so well, it's in the church, it's a combination of that power. And I remember being a pastor and, you know, people look at you different. I used to just want people to see me as a normal person, like my personal friends. And my therapist would tell me, you know, they're your friends, but you're also their pastor. That's never going to not be true, you know? So it's just a weird dynamic when you have this authority figure, this spiritual authority. Even if the people around me didn't really they made fun of me, they teased me, you know, they treated me like a normal person. But in the back of their thinking, I'm still their pastor. They don't want to crack that dirty joke or, you know, whatever with me around or whatever. And so there's that dynamic, obviously, as a part of this abuse. But there's also, and you've touched on this a little bit already, but I was wondering if you would say just a bit more and I think some of our listeners know how this works pretty well, but for those that don't, like, how does the theology of evangelicalism add to the risk factor, if you will, of predatory type of behavior?
No, I think risk factor is a really good word to use for that. In fact, that's the word I often use when I'm talking to people about this. As a matter of fact, I think this particular angle is one of the most often overlooked when it's being covered by the media, especially media that is not necessarily religious. You obviously have a religious background, but I think that often what happens is that religious belief, largely because of sort of the political rhetoric around it, is sort of viewed as sacrosanct, right? So like, this is my sincerely held religious belief. Like it should not be questioned. Like if it's my religious belief, then you can't question it or whatever. Right. But it's like, ultimately, I mean, here's the thing. There are so many things about conservative white evangelical theology, and particularly it's theology around sexuality, that lend itself to not just covering up abuse, but forming the bedrock of a culture of abuse. So, I mean, just talking about sex, okay, if you've got, let's say you've got a church, okay, you've got a church and they subscribe to purity culture. So the only acceptable expression of sexuality of any kind is between one cisgender heterosexual man and one cisgender heterosexual woman monogamously in a legal marriage for life. Okay.
That's a lot of qualifiers, but yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, but it's in the Bible though, don't you know?
No, no, I'm tracking.
The Bible says all of those things.
Justice of the peace right there in Genesis.
Exactly. Adam and Eve, you know? And so that's the starting place. All right. Usually what that means is that, sex ed is not really considered a positive thing. We want to reduce information about sexuality because if we teach kids how to use condoms, then they will use them is the line of reasoning, right? Mm-hmm. If we give girls the HPV vaccine, they become sluts. So there's little preparation, there's little education. You know, any kind of non-heterosexual sexuality is squashed. It is repressed. It is buried deep down. Then you've got the fact that they are primed to view usually men as being in charge spiritually, practically, whether that's at home, at church. I mean, sometimes your mileage varies on that depending on denomination, but usually men are assumed to be the spiritual leaders. You're looking up to men. Mm-hmm. Also, women are usually expected to dress modestly because what if you dress immodestly and a man sees your boobs and then has a sexual thought and you are responsible for turning him on, defrauding his future wife, and, you know, leading him down the path of destruction. So there's this expectation of like women as the gatekeepers of men's spirituality. So, definitely if we have a youth retreat, and a girl shows up in a bikini, we're putting a big old t-shirt on that because what if she incites some man to lust? You know, and so we have this culture, right, of this group of young people and especially a group of young women that are ignorant and naive about sexuality on purpose. They have no sex education. They've never heard the word consent. They view themselves as the followers and the subservient counterparts of men and also as the gatekeepers of male sexuality. Is that not a giant flashing vacancy sign for predators?
Yeah. And then, you know, then the religious authorities give clergy and other leaders the benefit of the doubt.
So that's not even talking. That's what I'm saying. That's not even talking about the non-sexual stuff. That's just the sexual stuff.
Right.
Then we get to the non-sexual stuff about religious authority, about clergy as being in charge, about like forgiveness theology and like all this kind of stuff, right? That the stuff that doesn't have to do with sex necessarily, but also adds to this. I mean, this is literally just a big flashing sign saying, predators, you will find your next victim here and we probably won't even blame you for it.
Right, exactly. And then, you know, you add on like different queer identities and that's out of bounds. You're not.
Well, and you can add a racial lens to it as well, because ultimately purity. I mean, this is people who are out there who are a lot smarter than me have written a lot more about this on the internet. But like ultimately, purity culture is an arm of white supremacy. You can't really win at purity culture unless you're white. Purity culture is for white people, particularly for white women. And it's basically to like assure the purity of white bloodlines, which like as gross as that sounds is true.
Yeah. And they've put it over a veneer of religiosity over it. And that's and you know, the roots of the KKK go back to white evangelicalism in America. I mean, this thing is
well, and
deep.
You can look at the launch of the modern purity movement as coming from like the failure of the resistance to civil rights. So there's that. That's a little thing I'm going to be writing about in hopefully a forthcoming book. I'm working on some book stuff, but that's
good.
That's one of my main I would say like historical ideas is just that like purity culture as it exists currently in the modern purity movement kind of stems out of this failure of the religious right to resist desegregation and the civil rights movement.
So they'll do it by reproduction.
And so that's why the change to the focus on abortion and all of that. So, that's kind of, I mean, there's all of that too. You can apply all of these lenses to it, like ad infinitum, ad nauseum, and just realize like how much of just an extreme miscarriage of justice the whole thing is.
So, and then on top of this, then recently we've seen evangelical leaders on sort of a sort of apology tour, kind of a PR tour. We had one a little while ago at Wheaton College, and the one I've been dying to tell you about, or obviously you know about it probably, but I'm going to be attending one of Al Mohler's Ask Me Anything tours.
You are not.
I am. He's coming to USC, where I'm the humanist chaplain.
I didn't know that he was doing that. That's very interesting.
He was at UCLA. I don't know how extensive it is. He was at UCLA a few weeks ago. And
do you know if he's marketed it at all?
There's a pretty schnazzy little trailer for it and some marketing materials. I'll send it to you.
I would love to see that. I would absolutely love to see how this is being marketed. Because, yeah, Al Mohler, I mean, he was one of the staunchest defendants of C.J. Mahaney. And he's always been one of the staunchest defendants of, like, sexist complementarianism as well. I mean, I remember when I was in Bible college, there was this whole, like, the case for early marriage Al Mohler article going around that, like, destroyed everyone and made it impossible to date anyone at Moody because they had all read this, like, Al Mohler case for early marriage article. And he was basically like, young people are going to have sex, so you better get married early so you don't sin. Yeah, no, it's a whole thing. It's a mess. But he also was like a staunch defender of C.J. Mahaney. And I think what's fascinating is that he is now in the age of church, too, coming out and saying, I'm sorry for defending C.J. Mahaney. But I don't know if you would get that without church, too. I don't know if people's asses weren't being held to the fire, I don't know if you would get half of what you're getting. I mean, like, I think of like the Willow Creek thing where... you know, their whole board resigned. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen without church, too. That doesn't happen without some serious social pressure.
Well, I want to ask him. I mean, he is like, I think the whole thing, like, I'll be super bummed out and tweet about this, you know, I'll tweet about it either way. But I don't think he's giving a big speech and then taking questions. I think the entirety of what he's doing is saying, ask me questions. And he wants them to be about, like, how can you believe in a short age of the earth? How can you...
it's not even about this?
Well, it's about anything, literally anything you want to ask him about faith or belief or anything.
Oh, my God. So it's not about like an apology tour, like sorry for.
No.
CJ, it's literally just, oh,
it's God. Like it's like basically I think he's trying to appeal to the young people and say, you know, come be a Christian. It's not so uncool, you know, that type of thing. And trying to be put a positive face. I mean, probably the Southern Baptist Seminary and the convention probably said, we need someone out there controlling the message. Like, and so I, you know, basically I want to ask him, look, I get that you're sorry, right? Like I got caught with my hand in the cookie jar a time or two by my mother as well. And I told her I was totally sorry. And what I meant was, I'm sorry I got caught. But you know, what in his mind, you know, I want to ask him, what in your mind do you see as the relationship between your theology of human sexuality and the results that you've seen in the Southern Baptist?
Well, they've already answered that. Honestly, their answer to that is that complementarianism and a conservative sexual ethic, it's the no true Scotsman thing, right? So they're like, complementarianism and a conservative sexual aspect, when followed correctly, would never lead to abuse. Like, if you're abusing someone, then you have failed to do those theologies correctly.
Well, that's
of Christianity. Real complementarianism protects women, and that's why there's so much abuse in Hollywood and Washington. That's why, like, the Gospel Coalition and all these, like, dudes who are into this type of theology love when abuse happens in Hollywood and Washington, because they get to point at it and say, see, Harvey Weinstein's a Democrat. Ha, ha, ha. That doesn't happen here because we are godly men. You know, like it's one. So it's really, they just ultimately, they pass it off as like a no true Scotsman thing forever and ever until we all die.
Right.
Because they say, oh, anybody who was really, truly following complementarianism and the traditional biblical sexual ethic would never do that, you know.
Yeah,
and I've got those people in my Twitter mentions every day. So,
and it really is not falsifiable. Like, you can't really argue with it. Like,
no, you can't prove it wrong because you just keep moving the goalpost. So it's actually kind of a genius marketing tool, but it's just really, really dangerous.
What you would need would be a bunch of perpetrators to sort of come forward and say, you know what, it was this theology that led me to this, and he let me explain.
Well,
how.
Yeah, and that'll never happen because they have no reason to.
Right,
there's nothing in it for them. So,
yeah, Yeah, it's the problem we face on so many issues. And I mean, honestly, Christianity in general, I mean, in terms of evangelicalism and conservative types of Christianity, it's the same whether we're talking about complementarianism and sexuality
or whatever else.
Or whatever else, you know, like.
Well, and that's so, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm a person who has experienced a lot of transition, you know, in how I see myself spiritually and how I see myself. Sexually, I used to think that I was like the straightest person I know. And now I know that I'm like very, very, very gay. you know, I think you can look back forever and you can go, okay, well, was that real? Was it not? And you can just drive yourself crazy about it.
Sure.
You know, you literally can read back anything that you want to read back. But I think that like, ultimately, while it's interesting to do that act of like personal archaeology, like ultimately what we have to be concerned about is like doing justice and like acting in ethical ways now, you know, in this present moment. We can go back and we can say, was that real? And I don't know, but like we're here, we're now, we're who we are in this exact moment. And so
right.
how are we gonna live the best way that we can live and try and enact justice in our spheres and in our world now with the information that we have now. And I think that's the most important thing.
Well, I know we're running low on time here. And I definitely want to at least give a nod to the fact that Emily Joy is not just Church 2, that you do other things that, you know, keep you busy and make you happy. What else do you keep yourself occupied with?
I do so many things. so, I mean, obviously I do a lot of Church 2 activism. I travel to speak about that a bit. I also do like performance poetry, like spoken word poetry, some about religious stuff, some about not. I teach yoga here in Nashville. And when I travel sometimes as well, I love that. Also, as of last week, I work admin at a church. Gasp. I do all kinds of stuff.
Whatever you have to do to make money, you know, it's.
Yeah. You know, it's just one of those things. But yeah, so I like to keep my finger on the pulse of these, of all of these conversations, because, you know, as I look at the conversations that are happening between, you know, evangelical and progressive Christianity and between progressive Christianity and atheist agnostics. And I look at all these conversations that are happening. I try to place myself on those spectrums and in those conversations. And I look at myself over time and just see how much that I have changed. And I realize that, like, you know, my personal beliefs, what I believe in my heart, ebbs and flows over time. You know, it's up and down. It changes. Sometimes I believe more things and other times I believe less. And, you know, it's not necessarily linear either. Sometimes it is circular. Sometimes things come back around. And, you know, ultimately, I think to me, what matters is that even though my beliefs ebb and flow over time, I'm a big believer in the idea of like justice work and like the get in where you fit in sort of model, the approach to that. And right. Like at the end of the day, like this is where I fit in.
Yep.
This is what I know how to talk about. Like, even if I don't believe X, Y, Z or whatever, like this is the work that I know how to do. I have a degree from Moody Bible Institute in Christian theology, specifically philosophical theology and apologetics. Right. Like I know how to have these conversations. I know how the sausage is made.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's one of those things where it's like, if this is, then this is where I get it. This is where I fit in. So this is where I'm going to get in. Like, this is where I'm going to do the work.
This is what
makes sense to me. And this is what I know how to talk about. And so sometimes, you know, people want to have those conversations with me about like, oh, are you a real Christian? And I'm like, I've got people in my inbox every week for the last 5 years telling me I'm not a Christian. I'm over that conversation.
Yep.
Like it's, I don't really care whether you think I'm a Christian or not.
And the more attention you get in social media and that type of thing, and you have like so many followers on Twitter, you really do have to be selective about the conversations that you're willing to have, because people will take up all your time.
No, I mean, I think one of the most liberating things is understanding like, hey, you don't have to respond to every piece of shit.
That's right.
That gets thrown at you. You get a lot of people asking you to do a lot of things. And here's the thing, like, I want to be helpful, right? So of course I'm going to send people like resources, and I'm going to be like, here's the Matthew Vines video talking about all of the Bible verses that don't actually mean that gay sex is a sin. Okay, that's interesting for you. There, you can read it. But then people who want me to like interpret stuff for them and have fights, I'm like, no.
No, not going
like,
there.
That's not going to happen. Yeah.
And you said you're working on a book?
Hopefully. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I am working on a book. The hopefully is more with regards to whether it actually comes to fruition. But yes, I am in the process of that.
Fantastic. Well, I hope it does come to fruition. You have a lot to say, and I think, you know, in a way that people can hear it and need to hear it. And, so best of luck to you on all of that. It takes time, but, yeah, I hope you'll stay with it, 'cause I think it's important what you're saying, and I love the way you say it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's nice for me to be able to like do these types of things and, you know, talk to like different audiences and all that stuff. I love it. So yeah. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being on the show. Where can people find you if they want to follow you?
Yeah. So I am Emily Joy Poetry on most things. That's Twitter. That's Instagram. If you just look me up, Emily Joy, you'll find my Facebook page. You can like it. You go to those places, you can find all my contact information. I would love to come and like speak at your thing. If you have like a school or a church or a conference or a festival or whatever it is that you do,
sure.
I'm available for that. Yeah. Just, find me on the internet. It's very nice when I say things to know that I'm not just like, screaming into the void, you know?
Yep. So. Thanks again. And we'll be in touch with you down the road, I hope.
Yeah. Thank you.
As Emily and I were mentioning in our conversation, the Church 2 movement has grown quite significantly, so much so that the evangelical community has offered some pushback and also some PR responses and meager attempts to address the concerns being raised by the women and sometimes men that are part of Church 2. If you're on Twitter, check it out. You can search the hashtag, read more stories, and follow some of the significant voices in this movement, including Emily's. In case you're wondering, I didn't end up going to hear Al Mohler at USC as I initially thought I might. In conversation with my secular student fellowship students at USC, we decided that it wasn't going to be worth our time, that it was a PR stunt primarily, and there probably wouldn't be any significant feedback from him. Part of my decision also was influenced by Emily's comments to me here in this conversation, in which she indicated that Al Mohler and the Southern Baptist Convention have already responded to these types of questions in the past, and they have ready-made pat answers. So rather than spend a Friday evening at USC listening to Al Mohler, I decided to stay home, and I don't regret it a bit. I hope you appreciated Emily's story. I'd love to hear what you think of this episode. Please write to me, if you wish, at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. Tell me what you thought. Ask questions. If you want to suggest future guests and topics for the podcast, I'd love to hear that, too. You can always reach me at ryan@lifeaftergod.org. If you want to learn more about the Life After God podcast and community, you can visit our website at lifeaftergod.org. While you're there, you can also find all the links to our social media and follow us on all those various platforms that we love. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and so forth. I'd also really appreciate it if you would go to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. It really helps the podcast grow in visibility on the iTunes platform, helps more people find us, and just helps us gain more credibility in the podcast community. So go to iTunes, search for Life After God, give us a rating. If you're feeling super generous, give us a review, and also subscribe to the podcast while you're there. If you'd like to become a member of the Life After God community and be a part of making all of this happen, please go to my Patreon page at patreon.com/lifeaftergod. There you can make any size recurring monthly donation from $1 up to as much as this podcast is worth to you. As always, thanks to my executive producer, Jeff Straka. Until next time, my name is Ryan Bell, and this has been the Life After God podcast.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.